Okay, so what's going to happen here is I'm going to talk through how I would plan the 2018 interpretations paper. There are six steps to this, and I'm going to go through them one by one. I open the paper, and the first thing that catches my eye is that this interpretations paper is going to be about Alexander. It could, of course, be about Khrushchev or the provisional government. So my first step is to have a proper look at the question. And the question says this: evaluate the interpretations in both of the two passages and explain which you think is the more convincing about the consequences of Alexander II's great reforms. Now, I noticed three things about this question. One, it's about Alexander. Fine. Two, it's about the consequences, which means effects. I'm not going to be writing about the causes, which is a bit of a blow to me because I know all that stuff, but I've got to answer the question that's there. Three, I notice it says the great reforms. Capital letters, so it's a proper noun, but it's also plural. What does that mean for me? Well, it's really talking about the reforms of the 1860s. Okay? So this is an interpretation that is focused really on the start of Alexander's reign. It's not one that's asking me so much about the drift to reaction and that type of stuff. Okay, so I've got two passages here. I would be expecting one of these passages to be more positive about the reforms and one of them to be more negative. Okay? They are long. Passage B has three paragraphs. Passage A has one substantial paragraph. I'm going to read them for the benefit of the recording now, and then I'm going to move on to stage two of this process, which is to try to work out what they say. In the exam, if I've got 10 to 15 minutes, I'd probably want to read them at least twice, probably three times, to be honest. So here we go. From A History of Russia, published in 2004, passage A. The great reforms changed the social fabric profoundly in a manner that legislators had not planned. Interesting. It's saying big change, but unintentional change. Does it matter that it's unintentional? It says about the consequences, not the motives. So this is probably saying there's going to be big change here. Yeah? I don't need to get sucked into the motives. See how I'm talking myself through it. In the 1860s and the 1870s, saw a sudden explosion of culture as towns acquired real meaning as the focus of political, legal and cultural life. Oh, hello, I'm just thinking lateral reforms is what's going on my mind here. Yeah? Okay, the population of small towns doubled. I don't know anything about this. We haven't really done this. We briefly mentioned Reutern. Okay, I'm going to try to keep going for a minute. Railroads began to slowly bridge the vast distances of European Russia with the construction of a line from St. Petersburg to Warsaw and from Moscow to Novgorod. Factories sprouted on the outskirts of towns. Oh, hello, this is this idea of the serfs, the emancipation of the serfs, to allow economic development and Reutern. I've done that for my further reading. Okay, factories sprouted on the outskirts of towns and ambitious landowners' estates. Industry flourished in the central industrial region. Textiles in Ivanovo. Mining and metallurgy underwent a revival. The drab provincial town of Livni, which before the reform produced agricultural products, boasted 18 major factories. Gosh, this is very detailed. A series of efforts were made to improve the sanitary conditions of the towns and villages as pipelines and sewage systems were installed. This is full of examples of things suggesting that Alexander's reform improved Russia. That's what I'm getting in my head. The atmosphere of the town and the estates changed, as well as an energetic young scientist, priests, teachers, physicians, working in the countryside, attended the Zemstvo. Specific reference to the lateral reforms. The Zemstvo became the cornerstone. Not sure I agree with that, actually. That's something I'll talk about with a weakness, maybe. and became the cornerstone of a distinctive and original political culture. It gave people experience of politics, and it was a defining institution of the era that followed the great reforms. All I want to do in my first reading of this is to decide its position, and it's clearly positive. Can I prove that with a quotation? Because this is my second stage, isn't it? I'm lucky here because it could be anywhere in the passage, but it's actually in the first sentence. The great reforms changed the social fabric profoundly. Okay? And profoundly, I'm going to take to read there as positively. That's a quotation I'm going to put into my introduction. Yeah? Okay. I'm now going to come to passage B. It doesn't actually matter who said it because I'm not evaluating it for provenance at all. Okay. From Dean Saunders, Russia in the Age of Reaction and Reform. I'm going to read it through again and I'm going to try to decide what position it takes. I'm thinking, before I even look at it, that it's going to take a more critical view of the reforms. Okay. It's possible to level criticism at most of the reforms that ensued after 1861. Peasants remained the poorest and the most heavily exploited section of the population. Those who engaged in agriculture were only short of land, but also saddled with redemption payments. Ah, so they're using different evidence. I can definitely play around with that. By retaining the poll tax and introducing new courts, the government made it plain that it had no intention of granting the peasantry economic or judicial parity with the nobility. The zemstvo became the nests of the gentry. That's interesting. So they're also using the same evidence in different ways. The first passage we're talking about the zemstvo in a very positive way, the second in a very negative way. The peasantry could have played a much larger part in their activities, but the former serfs were unable to rid themselves of the habit of deference. Now, I know what deference means. It means just going along with things. But if you didn't know a word like that, you can work your way around it. I'm in the back of my mind, I'm remembering, if there's a word I don't know, it's one word within a whole argument. So that's not going to paralyse my process. At a district level, the new assemblies were too remote from the peasants' concerns to justify the risk of throwing caution to the wind. Don't really understand that. But the chairmen of the zemstvo were elected by assemblies, so they had to be approved by the Ministry of Internal Affairs. Right, what this is arguing is that it's continuity, not change. Yeah? In the eyes of the government, the zemstvo were fundraising bodies rather than forums for political discussion. Yet, because the zemstvo lacked the power of enforcement, they couldn't collect taxes. Indeed, the major drawback of the reforms was the Tsar's refusal to establish a national assembly. Right, so it's really bringing in these limitations. I might want to be talking about Lois Melikoff there. That's a little note to myself. There can be no doubt that there was a decision made by the Tsar himself, for his own brother and a number of highly placed officials recognise the advantages of establishing some type of central representative body. The Tsar, however, was not persuaded. Since the Tsar made a law on his own, it may be that the reforms of the 1860s were a grand illusion. Oh, I think I might be using that quotation in my introduction. The measures enacted by Alexander II were conceptually limited, poorly executed, incomplete, unsustained, and insecure. Okay, so I'm coming to the end of my second phase now. And in my second phase, I want to say, does passage B take a different view? And it clearly does. Where passage A says that the reforms improved life in Russia, passage B suggests that they made very little difference. Where in passage A, the quotation that gives the interpretation can be found in the first line, in passage B, I'm picking it out at the very end. I'm going to pick that because it's so strong, that phrase, a grand illusion, and then embed that and then take it that it says it was conceptually limited, poorly executed, incomplete, unsustained, and insecure. So I've kind of got my introduction, except I need to work out the position I'm going to. The third thing I need to do now is talk about the strengths and weaknesses of A. And then the fourth thing will be the strengths and weaknesses of B. When I've done both of those, I then need to be in a position where I decide which one I agree with more. Okay? If I was in the exam, I would then reread them again before colour coding them. Yellow, strength, green, weakness. Okay? And what I'm looking to do is have an academic conversation. So let's go back to passage A. What does it do that I really like? Well, it has a focus correctly on how economic modernisation could lead to a higher standard of living. And it does talk about the Zemstvo as well. So these are, the phrase I would use, central planks of an argument that you would expect to be, that you would expect from an argument saying that life was made better. However, perhaps they put too much emphasis on specific examples. Russia is this massive country, and there's no real analysis of how typical Livni is, for example. Or was it particularly favoured? Was it a typical example? Okay? It suggests towns become the centre of political, legal and cultural life. But actually, Russia in 1861, or 1871 for that matter, is still an autocracy. So I might challenge that. Russia is run through the six sections and particularly is controlled by the third section, which is the secret police under Alexander. So perhaps in this, the author overstresses the degree of liberation. It is also noteworthy that in a country that is over 80% rural in Alexander II's time, there's no mention of the countryside at all. Moreover, if I'm looking at this, there are some significant omissions. There's nothing about, to quote J.S.A. Grenville, the cruel joke of the emancipation, lowering standards of life and making the peasants even poorer, often being in a more oppressive type of autocracy. Moreover, if you were going to take the argument that you'd expect to find here, you'd expect there to be some type of focus on the most improving of the reforms, and they would be the military reforms of Milutin, and they would be the legal reforms that allowed trial by jury. I haven't made my mind up yet because I need to have a trawl through passage B, but it seems to me that this is quite a partial, and maybe the phrase I would use is overly optimistic, view of the impact of the reforms. Certainly, the reforms triggered a rise in opposition, and that seems counterintuitive to me. Why are there people trying to kill Alexander II in 1866? Why is he moving back to reaction with people like Tolstoy and Shuvalov if this is such an unqualified success? Okay? It seems to be a partial and overly optimistic and underdeveloped argument to my mind. Passage B seems to be a more substantial undertaking. Okay, it highlights the more central planks of a typical argument in this area. So, it focuses on the impact of the redemption payments on the newly liberated, in inverted commas, serfs. They represent 80% of the population, or thereabouts. So, the limitations of the Zemstvo are properly discussed, but it is worth making the point there is also quite a partial view here. the biggest freedom of all the emancipation activities was unquestionably Milutin's military reforms, which were introduced from 1871 onwards. These aren't referred to, and they were life-changing. Arguably, a National Assembly was a longer-term significance. But in the shorter term, the legal reforms and the military reforms were probably more substantial. So perhaps this author is overstressing the impact on the ruling classes, if we were making a criticism of him. The final point to make at this stage is that, of course, the author is incorrect when he talks about the National Assembly, because although Alexander II doesn't introduce a National Assembly, he changes his mind on that, and at the point of his assassination in 1881, he's about to sign the Lawrence-Melikoff proposal, which will allow for the creation of a Duma, or Parliament, and a written constitution. So the author here has some limitations. So both are imperfect. I'm now in a situation where I've picked out the key terms in the question. One, I've identified the position of the passages. Two, I've pulled out the strengths, weaknesses and omissions of the two passages. Three, I now, four, need to make a decision about which passage I think is stronger. And I'm going to go with passage B. I think passage B, because it talks more about the majority of the population. Okay? The fifth thing I need to do then is to work out my batting order. I have my two quotations for the contrasting interpretations in my introduction, and I'm going to say in my introduction that passage B will be best supported. The fifth thing I need to do then is I need to make sure what order I'm going to do it in, and I'm going to go in the classic order of doing the weakest passage first, A, and the stronger passage, B, second. The final thing I would need to do, and I will do this after I've written my introduction and my three paragraphs, is work out how I'm going to ensure that I've got a substantial conclusion. And that substantial conclusion would need to say what the strongest strength and biggest weakness of both passage A and passage B is. And that is how you do it, baby.